greatness of a nation and its moral progress can be judged by the way its animals are treated. So said Mahatma Gandhi. Good afternoon. Welcome to Animal Voices here on CFRO 102.7 FM on Community Radio in Vancouver. And we have a very interesting show for you today. We have two special guests. Our first guest is Devlin Kuyak of GRAIN, an organization which is is formed to foster genetic diversity. And the second part of our show is going to be with Carl Loskin, who's here in the studio with us, and that's going to be about the food guide. You want to say a little bit about that, Carl?
Yes, so the Health Canada is doing a series, getting input from the public about the food guide and revising it. And to help us understand the complexity of it all, we'll be speaking with Vasanta Molina. She is a registered nutritionist and author of books such as Raising Vegetarian Children, Becoming Vegetarian, and Becoming Vegan. Many of these books she has co-authored with Brenda Davis. That's at the halfway mark today.
Well, we'll look forward to that. That's great. And, of course, our first interview is going to be with GRAIN and the poultry industry's central role in the bird food crisis. Now, our computers are not up and running here, so I'm going to have to do things a little different. I thought I had a bio of Devlin Kuyak, who's our guest. Are you there, Devlin?
Okay.
Hello, Devlin. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hello.
I wonder if you could just say a little bit about yourself and the organization that you work for.
Sure. I'm a researcher with GRAIN, and I'm based in Montreal. We're an international organization. We have about 14 people on the team, and we're all based and living in different parts of the world. And we work on issues that are impact on biodiversity, particularly the consequences for small farmers.
Now, you've written a devastating report on the poultry industry and avian flu and the central role of factory farming rather than backyard flocks being responsible for these terrible outbreaks all over the world. Why is it that the effort seems to be concentrated on attacking the wrong party here, rather than investigating or at least going with the findings that present evidence that factory farms are really responsible for the breeding of this highly pathogenic virus. Instead, the backyard flocks are being targeted and the poor of the world. Can you discuss that a little bit, please?
Yeah, well, what we're seeing is, I mean, when we first started looking into this, we really didn't know where the research would take us, but it became immediately apparent that there was a big contradiction between what was being carried in the media and being said by a lot of the international agencies, governments, veterinarians. What they were saying was that this disease was essentially a product of people living, you know, in proximity with poultry in Asia, of backwards traditional poultry practices, open air poultry rearing. And when we looked more closely, we saw, well, that it was clear that there were outbreaks happening in factory farms, that this wasn't being given any attention. That that most of the poultry that was dying were in factory farms. But that, of course, there was the poor and the backyard farms were being singled out. So there was a way more attention being given to backyard farms than was justifiable, given that the disease was really a product of the factory farming systems. And when we started looking at even the studies that had been done previously on bird flu, because bird flu is not necessarily a brand new disease. It has some history. The H5N1 is a more recent development, but other variants of bird flu, of highly pathogenic bird flu, have erupted around the world at various points. And those studies show that what can happen is a low pathogenic strain enters into the factory farm, and once it's in that kind of dense, overcrowded conditions, the disease evolves. The virus evolves quite rapidly into a highly pathogenic farm, and from there, in a side of factory farm, it can spread quite easily. There's all kinds of channels, whether it's through the air because of the viral load that's created, whether it comes out in the water. And the waste that's generated, including litter that is used to produce feed, and then can be often sprayed on fields. So I mean the channels through which the fact that the industry is so globalized, and that if there are a lot of these farms are producing hatchable eggs or day-old chicks, and those are sent around the world. So the movement of poultry is another major factor in the spread of the disease. Now, why is the attention being placed on backyard farms? Well, I think it's certainly much easier politically to say those kinds of things, because by and large, small-scale backyard farmers are not highly organized. They have very little political influence. They're some of the more marginal people in the countries that are affected, and it's quite easy to foist the blame upon these people, instead of looking at the larger poultry industry, and many governments and international agencies have been heavily involved in promoting these industries. So I think that's part of the reason. A lot of it also comes from just sheer arrogance, ignorance, and insensitivity to backyard farming as well.
Speaking of arrogance and insensitivity, a gentleman professor in England, I believe, has suggested that we should replace all the chickens in the world with transgenic, that is to say, genetically modified chicken, and this will solve the problem. Nature is stupid. Our professors are wonderful, brilliant geniuses who are going to save the world.
Yeah, well, and maybe shows a real lack of understanding of the virus itself too. I mean, the influenza virus evolves so rapidly, and it mutates constantly. So to imagine that you can just come up with some transgenic chicken with resistance is really insane. Especially when you consider the ways in which the control operations are handled. When an outbreak happens, generally, the governments just follow the World Health Organization recommendations, and that's to call all birds within a 10-kilometer radius of the outbreak. Now, this can be, in the case of India, we saw there was 7 samples that were collected from various villages that showed that there had been an infection of the virus, and some birds had died from the virus. Now, the culling then it happens on a large scale. It involves countless numbers of birds in different communities, and the biodiversity is very rich in the backyard flocks in these communities. Some of those birds may very well have higher degrees of resistance to the virus than others, but none of that is considered. And so your flock may be perfectly healthy, and the ways that the farmers may be managing disease may be working very well, but it doesn't matter, because your birds will simply be culled. And these are this is the livelihoods of these people. This is the culture of these people. It's devastating.
Yeah, and it may devastate many villages, because within a radius of so many kilometers, there may be very many villages who are dependent on this for livelihood and for protein and food.
Yeah, and we rarely see, we rarely hear stories about how it's impacting on people. When you consider, in many cases, the poorer farmers, they don't have the means to buy larger livestock. So the only livestock they would have would be these chickens, and the chickens, of course, would scavenge. And it's an affordable way to have livestock, and many farmers use it also in integrated ways on their farms. And so losing these chickens is just it's completely devastating, especially if they're traditional village chickens, because that you can't just simply get new stock for that kind of those varieties, and when they're gone, that's it. And there's no big gene banks for that are going to start supplying these small farms with the stocks that they had before. What they'll end up getting is the stocks from the industrial farms, and that has absolutely nothing to do with their ways of farming.
Now, it's basic science, isn't it, that hygiene and so on, good hygiene, open conditions, good air and good food are the very factors that will create resistance to the mutations of this very highly mutatable flu virus. So, but surely that mutation will come very soon to settle in a very crowded conditions such as exist, and filthy conditions such as exist on these these factory farms. So the basic science is surely with the outdoor poultry producers and the organic producers.
Well, yeah, and there's those studies that do exist do seem to point in that direction, but there's very, very little research that's been done. I mean, it's if you look at some other diseases, say with Newcastle disease, I mean, it's just the experts simply understand that it, you know, it's going to mutate into a dangerous form within the factory farm conditions, and it's going to exist in an endemic form within backyard situations, but that's not going to be necessarily a major problem, and you're not going to have the type of mass outbreaks that you will have with a highly pathogenic form. And those, you know, that highly pathogenic form simply isn't going to evolve in these non-dense backyard flock situations. But with avian flu, with the bird flu, that just seems to be all forgotten, and it's incredible. If you look through the literature, you see almost nothing, almost no reference when it comes to bird flu to experience with other diseases. And it's as if, you know, the whole experience that we've had over the years has just been simply erased. And you look at recent bird flu outbreaks before the H5N1, and in British Columbia, in the Netherlands, in Chile, in the U.S., in all of these cases, in Japan, in all these cases, you know, these supposedly very biosecure, highly modernized factory farms, the disease somehow erupted in these factory farms and then spread. Sometimes it affected backyard flocks, but rarely. And where it does affect backyard flocks, the mortality rate seems to be quite low. So all these things suggest that, you know, point the finger quite clearly to the factory farms as being the problem, and saying backyard farms, well, you know, these are places of that actually are able to control and work with the virus.
Now, the World Health Organization and the FAO, I forgot now what it stands for.
Food and Agriculture Organization.
Yes. Now, what's their attitude, and it's changed, hasn't it?
Well, the Food and Agriculture Organization for years ran programs supporting small-scale family poultry farming. And it varied. I mean, there were some that were very supportive of helping traditional practices. Others that were much more geared towards modernizing poultry farming, so that they would have, in a sort of the Green Revolution style, they called it the Livestock Revolution, and they tried to get farmers to use higher yielding breeds, to use industrial feeds, and these kinds of things. And they ran those programs in places like Afghanistan. And all of a sudden, since bird flu has erupted, they started saying, well, backyard farming is the problem, and, you know, these places need to get modernized. But now they're saying, well, okay, yes, the poultry industry is the problem, but it's not the big, large-scale, biosecure factory farms, you know, these highly modern ones run by corporations. The problem is these smaller-scale commercial poultry farms that, you know, of the kind that they've actually been encouraging with their livestock revolution programs, and they're saying, well, you know, these ones are the problem, and these ones are the ones that need to go. But, I mean, these are still small farms, and the people have spent a lot of money, gone into a lot of debt trying to scale up towards where the FAO was at one point saying they should go.
Mm-hmm. That's in Afghanistan.
Well, that's all over. Oh. But, I mean, Afghanistan is one of the places,
yeah.
You know.
Now, bird flu is really nothing new, as you said, and it's coexisted peacefully with wild birds, right? Now, what is this idea that the wild bird is the vector of this disease?
Well, I mean, they've had a hard time, you know, if you don't point your finger at the poultry industry, then you have a hard time explaining how the virus has spread. And so their theory was, well, that it's wild birds. And it's true that wild birds are the natural host for bird flu. But it's always in a low pathogenic form. And wild birds have shown to be, in almost all cases, at least as susceptible to the virus in its, you know, the H5N1 highly pathogenic strain as poultry. So what bird watchers are saying is that, you know, what's actually happening is that the low pathogenic form may go from the wild birds, may be transferred into poultry, but It only evolves into a highly pathogenic form and a dangerous form in the factory farming operations. And then birds can be affected. Birds can, you know, share the same water, or they can pass through some of these farms. Or, I mean, there's the when the manure is spread on fields. There's any number of sources where these passing wild birds can contract the virus from poultry, and then it seems like they die quite quickly. Now, some birds seem to be able to fly for short distances with having been infected, such as the swans that we're seeing in Europe. But by and large, there's almost no evidence to suggest that the wild birds are in fact spreading the virus in its highly pathogenic form to poultry.
Veterinarians are much more likely to be a vector, aren't they?
Yeah, sure. Veterinarians in the case of France, they're saying it's journalists. Going from farm to farm trying to get a story. And in the case of Europe too, I mean, there are a lot of outdoor free-ranging farms, and in both cases where they've had outbreaks in Western Europe, it's been in these closed farms, and so they've been scratching their heads trying to figure out how can this disease that have erupted in two instances where the farms were completely closed and sealed off from wild birds.
Now, you say that the global poultry industry is the root of the bird flu crisis, but it's an established fact that we're going to have factory farms of animals, and that's not going to change overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And how does one deal with this situation? I mean, we can pinpoint it away from what is being said, but is there another step there that we should be looking at here?
Well, it's one thing to say it can't be done. I mean, look at what happened in Egypt. In Egypt, when they had their outbreaks, what did they do? They called for a complete national call. And this is an area very rich in poultry biodiversity. They called for a complete national call. They banned backyard and rooftop poultry raising, which goes back centuries in Egypt. They decimated their poultry industry. They forced a closure of the live poultry markets, which is, again, supplies 80% of the poultry meat to Egyptians. And we're saying to vendors that they would be providing freezers, which hasn't happened. So the only thing you can buy now is frozen poultry, and they've been forced to import poultry now. So it's incredible the lengths that the governments will actually go in implementing this when it comes to the what they'll do to backyard farmers.
Farmers were even unable to slaughter their own chickens. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so these measures are severe and extreme when it comes to backyard farming, which is something that goes back generations and generations and is so important culturally, ecologically for so many reasons. And yet when it comes to factory farms, and in most countries, the factory farms are producing for export or producing for the KFCs and the middle class urban market. So to say that those are the vital farms is a bit of a stretch. What's much more vital in terms of source of protein for people are the small scale farms.
And in less than a month, the Egyptian government effectively destroyed the whole multi-billion-dollar poultry industry.
Yeah, exactly.
And the livelihoods of millions of Egyptians.
Mm-hmm. And I mean,
and started importing
farmers, workers as well, and vendors. I mean, it's incredible what happened there.
And then start importing meat, probably from the large American corporations, frozen meat and so on, which is dietarily far inferior in terms of quality than would be the rooftop farming.
No, and sure, and more dangerous too. I mean, they are talking about frozen meats being, being shipped around in a developing country. It's hard to imagine that that's the safest means of selling meat.
And the Egyptian website, the government website, clearly lists initial outbreaks at three factory farms.
Yeah, well, the news that came out immediately was that this was simply a problem of backyard farms. I mean, this happens everywhere. It happened in Ukraine. It happened in Thailand. The governments will come out and immediately blame the factory, the small-scale farms, and say, well, no, this isn't a problem with our chicken industry, like the large-scale commercial farms. This is a problem with the backyard farms. And then 2 days later, we find out that no, okay, it wasn't just in the backyard farms, but it's been it's rampant in the factory farms. And in fact, one company in Egypt confided to us that half the factory farms in the country were affected, and over 25 million birds had been culled. I mean, this is not backyard farming that's the problem there.
Now, would you confirm that in British Columbia, where we had an outbreak last year, and it was the farmers were, of course, supported by the provincial government, that there was only one outbreak on an organic chicken outfit, and that outfit was opposite a big factory farm? So it's really, it is an example of how correct you are with your assessment.
Yeah, no, that's what I understand of the situation in British Columbia, and that's what happened also in Netherlands. It's what happened in Japan. It's what happened in Chile and the United States. I mean, wherever these outbreaks seem to occur, it's almost always can be traced back to a factory farm. And in the case with the H5N1. In almost any veterinarian report, the source is always listed as inconclusive.
What happened in Laos, and why is it an exception? And does it demonstrate the rule?
I'm not sure how much of an exception it is. I think it's happened in other countries, but it's just that Laos is better documented. I mean,
and it was almost untouched by factory farms.
Well, yeah, the few factory farms that they have in the country were touched, but the small scale ones were not. And the disease has been quickly dealt with in the country. And what Laos has that Thailand doesn't have, or Vietnam doesn't have, is the fact that it's backyard farms. And these are farms that are not integrated at all with the industry, so that's very different from in Vietnam and Thailand, because the small-scale farms don't get their stock, they don't get their feed, they don't get anything from the large-scale industry, they don't import that. They use local sources, and they also sell in local markets. So there's very little integration between the two, and the disease remained confined only to the large-scale farms, didn't touch the small-scale farms. But, I mean, the same thing is happening in Nigeria, where it seems like the disease, at least initially, was confined to a few factory farms, well, one factory farm in particular that seems to be the source, and then it spread through the movement of birds from that factory farm. So it was easily traced to that one source. And I think in the same situation I'm sure has happened in other countries, except where you get an integration between the two, where factory farms are more integrated, say where the birds are sold in the same markets, or where the veterinarians are the same. Or in the case of Thailand, there's a lot of small scale farmers are doing contract farming for the bigger companies, so there's always this constant integration of the two. That's I think where you get the disease spreads quite rapidly into the backyards.
Now, the transformation of the poultry production in Asia is pretty staggering over the last decades. And I think its production jumped eightfold in just 30 years, from around 300,000 metric tons to 2,440,000 metric tons in 2005. That's a span of 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
In China, too, as people are moving to the cities and want cheaper meat, or cheaper food, I suppose, and they're replacing their grain with meat all over Asia, aren't they? Which is a terrible mistake, because grain and carbohydrate is really the proper food for human beings, not this excess protein.
Yeah, well, I mean, people in villages also have access to chicken. It's just when your model of development is to move people into dense urban areas to work in factories, where there's no agriculture being practiced around, there's no urban agriculture being done, and you're supplying them with meat from factory farms nearby. I think this is the kind of conditions that you're creating. It's just ripe for these kinds of diseases. And whether or not that is the best way for people to eat, I think that's a good point. I think there are many better ways to achieve food security, but it's a larger question, because it has to do with the economic development models too that people are pursuing.
And the World Bank is involved, the FAO, the World Health Organization, and American corporations and USAID, of course.
Yeah.
Can you tie those together a little bit for us? And is it possible to see a conspiracy here?
Well, I don't think it's so much a conspiracy. I think it's just the way that the system tends to operate. I think the system that we have perpetuates itself by creating greater risks that it, you know, claims to be the only possible way to resolve. So it creates problems and resolves them. I mean, we see this with GMOs, for instance. I mean, you know, the pesticide industry creates all these problems with its with the model of agriculture that it promotes, and then comes out conveniently with a new patented product, the GM crops in this case, that claims can resolve the problems that people are facing with the old model. So it's this is the same thing happening with in this case with the bird flu. You know, we have traditional forms of agriculture. And by traditional, I don't mean backwards. I mean, these are highly inventive, innovative, and productive systems of agriculture. But they get constantly replaced with this push towards modernization and trying to bring people into these more commercial structures. And then that generates problems. And when that generates problems, then they're told that they need to even go further with what they have. And you get to the point where people just lose all capacity to do anything on their own, and they become completely dependent.
A final question: reaction will your report generate, or has it generated so far?
Well, if you do a Google search on it, you'll find millions of hits, because the response from I think people informally has been tremendous. We've received hundreds of comments and people thanking us for the report, for putting together this research. You know, the information was out there, but people had it and the media certainly hadn't put it together in this kind of way. And so I think informally it's been circulated, small farmers have been sharing it widely, and we keep getting responses in that sense. The mainstream media has been slower to respond, but it has been picking it up. There was quite a good article in the Los Angeles Times that raised the same arguments and referenced our report. And then not long after, The Lancet, which is one of the top medical journals in the world, wrote an editorial where they referenced our report and backed our position. So, you know, mainstream is coming around a bit on this. You know, we also wrote letters to the FAO and haven't heard back from them, and their position seems to be getting more and more dangerous, I'd say.
Shame, shame.
Mm-hmm.
Devlin, thanks very much for being our guest today and all this information. What's your website so people can look up this report here?
Yeah, if people just go to our homepage, they'll find it. It's www.grain.org.
Thanks for being our guest.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
Right. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
That was Devlin Kuyek. Spoke to him in Montreal, and he's with Grain, GRAIN. If you go to his website, grain.org, you'll be able to read the document there, and the press release is very fascinating information. We'll go for a little break, and after that we're going to be back with Vicente Molina and the Canadian Food Guide and its revisions. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Animal Voices on CFRO 102.7 FM here in Vancouver.
Brings in spring Friday, April 21st from 9 p.m. till 10:30 p.m. Spring has sprung with the brightest, bounciest, and most boisterous batch of Vanishing Vinyl.
All right, from vintage rock and roll, like like the Birds, the Beach Boys, and the Knickerbockers, Chuck Berry. All right, to old soul, Otis Redding, Bertha Dillman, Sam and Dave, and something weird by Steeler's Wheel.
Yeah, all you have to do is tune in, and we have some thank you gifts for you for tuning into Co-op Radio and becoming members at 604-684-8494.
Friday night, April 21, and Sister Van Boover brings in spring. Oh, no, it's not Halloween, it's spring. My mistake.
Yeah, that's 9 to 10:30 p.m., but it is part of Co-op Radio's 2006 Spring Marathon Drive, and once again, that is April 21st to May 7th. Bring in spring in style.
Welcome, everyone, to Animal Voices. And, yes, our webpage is www.animalvoices.org. Many of our programs can be heard on our webpage, www.animalvoices.org. Well, we're very pleased to let you know that Vicenta Molina is on the line, and she's a registered nutritionist and the author of books such as Raising Vegetarian Children, Becoming Vegetarian, and she's co-authored these books with Brenda Davis, and also the latest book is called Becoming Vegan. Welcome to Animal Voices, Vicenta Molina.
Hello, Carl.
Yes, so you know, what's been in the news lately is the revision of the food guide. Health Canada apparently has been working on that for some 4 years to revise it, and they had hearings in Vancouver earlier this week, and you attended.
That's right. It was very exciting, and these events are happening across Canada, in Winnipeg, in Toronto, in different cities. So our Vancouver one was last week, on Monday, April 10th.
So what were your impressions, and what needs to be done with the food guide?
Well, I was very favorably impressed. I felt for many years that there were some serious flaws in the food guide, and it's a very challenging thing to attempt, to put a guide for all Canadians onto one piece of paper. But I felt they could do better than they were. And I was very favorably impressed that they're moving in the right direction, from my perspective, on this next guide. And I think we have some advantages over the Americans in our guide, in that the people who put out the food guide in Canada are Health Canada. So it's a branch of the government that has an interest in health, whereas in the United States, the people that put out the food guide are the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they have a big interest in selling a lot of meat and dairy products. And so while our guide has influences from industries, including these industries, in the United States, it's kind of like the voice of those industries, and so they have an even bigger challenge in having health confront these lobby groups.
So we're talking about the lobby groups, and basically, if I can read something from one of your letters, which really says it all, in which you wrote that in the 1940s and the 1950s, it didn't bother anybody what the food guide said, that dairy products, milk, cheese, etc., were depicted as essential to everyone's health and a necessary cornerstone of a balanced diet. And then you also mentioned that this guide was the ultimate marketing tool for the dairy industry. So now hopefully we'll see a situation where the focus will be more on preventing dietary deficiencies rather than also dealing with the previous one. We've seen this gigantic explosion of obesity throughout our nations.
That's right. On the guides that came out since the 40s, the emphasis was so much on meat and dairy products that at first, when we had the four food groups in a square shape, the meat group and the dairy group were depicted as equal size squares to vegetables and fruits, which were in another corner, and breads and cereals, which were in the fourth corner. So we had this emphasis that half of what you were supposed to eat would be meat and dairy, and that has resulted in these big fat bodies that we've got now in Canada with such an epidemic of obesity. And in this latest guide, there has been quite an emphasis on, okay, how do we address the obesity that's been happening in North America, and including in Canada, and how do we have our food guide help people eat well while not gaining such excessive amounts of weight?
Now, I also attended that, and the new food guide, do you think it will include these products that they put out the flyer on, which says milk, yogurt, cheese, fish, chicken, beef, eggs? Will the new guide include all of those foods?
It will, and I don't think Canadians as a whole are ready to drop those products by a long shot. But what we have as a positive advantage and a new development is that, for example, in the milk products group, we're including fortified soy milk as an alternative. And so that gives people the option of getting their calcium and vitamin D from a much healthier plant-based source of calcium rather than just insisting on dairy products for everybody. The milk group has been quite a contentious group as far as I can tell, because the milk group was definitely an industry promotion. And, I mean, we did used to think, though, that milk was nature's perfect food. And we thought that not just for cows, which are supposed to gain a tremendous amount of weight very quickly, baby calves, but we thought for humans that cow's milk was nature's perfect food. And that's turned out to be quite a strategical error in terms of it makes us grow fat too quickly.
Right, to the hormones.
Yeah, so when you have something like fortified soy milk, you've got a product that is nutritious, doesn't have the cholesterol, and has significantly less fat in it.
Why does it have to be fortified, though?
Oh, okay, well, that's an important one. Cow's milk is also fortified. It's fortified with vitamin D. And this was done to prevent rickets. And it actually did a very good job of doing that, because we knew that cow's milk would get to a lot of kids. Now, many children are allergic to cow's milk, and so we didn't have an option for them. And now fortified soy milk will be fortified, and has been since 1997, with vitamin D, and it also has equivalent amounts of calcium to cow's milk, and it has other nutrients such as vitamin B12 and riboflavin and zinc in it. So it's a very highly nutritious product and competes very easily, and it can even be considered a better alternative than cow's milk.
Now, Vicenta Molina...
I'd just like to mention one more thing about that milk group, that there are still a lot of other dairy products listed, and in terms of nutrients, these are quite inferior for the most part in that they are not fortified with vitamin D, and they're kind of in there as, you know, ways the Dairy Bureau wants us to be eating dairy products.
Well, I shake my head at the inclusion of condensed milk, if that has to be in there.
I know. Now, there are groups in Canada, way up north, that do use condensed milk. And that's one of the things, if you're going to have a food guide for Canadians, you have to think of, okay, what are Inuit doing and Native people and Aboriginal people in northern climates. But actually, milk is a very poor source of calcium for these people, because a lot of them are lactose intolerant. 70% of the world's population does not do well on milk sugar, and so to be insisting that all these people should be using cow's milk is pretty ridiculous.
Did the natives have rickets when the white man came?
They ended up getting rickets, but they used to have really different ways to get their calcium.
Sure.
They would cook bones in a big stew and get calcium from that. They'd be eating green vegetables that we don't eat today, like fiddlehead ferns, and just there were a lot of different styles of eating. And so we can't really compare. We have to find new ways to address the challenges. But making people of every race drink cow's milk is not a wise choice, because, for example, Asian people, Aboriginal people, Hispanics, African descent people have a 70 to 95% incidence of lactose intolerance. In other words, they get sick, they get bloated, they feel terrible. when they have the sugar that's in cow's milk, and it's in many other milk products as well. And so to be insisting that all these people use cow's milk is kind of a racist approach, I think.
You're darn right. And my question popped out of my head.
Okay.
Oh, anyway, I'd like to just change the tune here from the food guide.
Vitamin D, if I may. No, it's a pretty false argument to attribute the healing of rickets to milk when the milk is only fortified with vitamin
That's
D. It's vitamin
right.
D. It's a false argument.
Yeah, and so if we do fine in Canada in the summer months, we get enough vitamin D from sunlight, and in the from about April to October. And that's if you go outside and get about 15 minutes if you're light-skinned and maybe half an hour if you have darker skin of sunlight on your forearms and face. Then you're fine. Or you can go on a hike on Saturday and get your week's supply. But otherwise, in the winter, we find that Canadians really are kind of short of vitamin D. Now, another way you can get vitamin D is from fish oils, but I think that way is proving not to be a good choice for a lot of reasons. So that was a way that northern people and coastal people did get vitamin D as well.
Well, let's just mention the downside of eating fish is the high content of mercury.
Yeah, mercury is a problem. And, I mean, it's tremendously cruel. You look at those fish hooks that go into salmon or something, or all the bycatch, there's a huge environmental problems.
And even, I think, one of Health Canada put out a statement showing that, childbearing women should not be eating more than one portion of fish a week.
That's
because
right.
of the, damage
they've
it could cause to the fetus.
Yeah, they've specified high mercury kinds, but when you have as conservative a group as Health Canada saying, hey, take care with this, and it's a major industry for Canada, you know that there's some pretty serious problems looming. And so some of us go, well, if I were pregnant, I don't think I'd be wanting to eat even tiny amounts of a product that has toxic contaminants in it.
Now, I'd like to refer to some of your books, Vasanto, and one of them that people often ask about is raising vegetarian children, and you've written a book exactly about that.
Right, yes.
So give us a little view here. How would you reassure the mothers that raising vegetarian children is complete and adequate?
Well, it is well established that vegetarian children can do just as well, and sometimes by some standards, for example, less risk of obesity, do even better than non-vegetarian children. And this has been affirmed by Dietitians of Canada and the American Dietetic Association in the most recent position paper on vegetarian nutrition. So we know that you can do well raising vegetarian children. Our book, which is with Jo Stepaniak, who was an author on it, first author, and myself, it's with McGraw-Hill and just came out recently. That one tells people in a lot of detail how to manage, how to get enough of all the different nutrients when your baby's just a toddler and just coming off breast milk, when they're a teenager and they're wanting to eat like the other kids, just the whole spectrum. And we also talk about how to deal with social issues that come up in the process.
What is the most frequently asked question that mothers and parents will ask about raising vegetarian children?
I think one of the things that comes up the most is that their in-laws are kind of a bit worried, because it's a new area. The parents the grandparents look at this procedure that's happening, which they're not very familiar with, and go, oh my goodness. And I remember when I was doing cooking classes, having a grandmother come and bring her son and daughter-in-law, because this grandmother was having nightmares that the baby would grow up without adequate bone structure. But then she learned, as soon as she learned that there were all these other good calcium sources, then she went, oh, good, well, now I can sleep nights. And all she needed to know was that there were plenty of other good foods and exactly how to put together a good diet. And then it turns out, actually, that vegetarian teens, for example, eat better than non-vegetarian teens. So it can be a very good choice.
Now, your first bestseller book was Becoming Vegetarian.
That's right.
But Can you imagine the grandmother's nightmares becoming larger, looming larger, when she had to read your next book, which you co-authored with Brenda Davis, called Becoming Vegan?
Right. Well, usually when people are at that stage, they tend to get quite interested in nutrition. And so our book, all of these books actually, have become classics, not only with the general public, but among health professionals, because we really give people a lot of practical guidelines. And I should say that my website, if people want to see the covers of these, is www.nutrispeak, like NutriSpeak.com. And so we've gone into a lot of detail because people are really pioneering, but it's a very good choice to do because we find that there are so many health problems related with these massive amounts of animal products in the diet. I wanted to say something about one other food group that we talked about, the milk products group, but another thing that Health Canada is doing quite a good job of in this next guide is including a lot of alternatives to meat, and they still call the group meat alternates, and I wish they'd call it bean alternates. But they actually are recognizing that legumes, beans, peas, nuts, lentils, or peanuts, lentils, these are all very, very wise choices, and in fact, better choices. And so what they've done in this group, at least in the draft version we have right now, is to put the beans first as a first choice.
Great.
Yeah.
Now,
then we've got three other options listed pictorially. So we show people the beans. You know, they can use canned or dried. They can use nuts. They can use nut butters. So there's really a lot of plant-based options. And then tofu, which is also an excellent calcium source, which none of the other meats are, or meat alternates are.
Of course, there's also protein and grain, isn't there?
That's right.
Now, I'm a 190-pound, 6'4" male, obviously. Yeah. But
not wasting away by any means.
No, I still do the grass grind. And with these portions, you know, that's so confusing when Health Canada mentions 3 to 4, 4 to 6, 5 to 6, 2 portions. Give us an idea of the size of a portion and how many portions of vegetables and fruits do you think I should consume for optimum health?
Well, this is one of the real challenges because, as you know, when you're talking about a three-year-old, you're lucky if you can get a couple of tablespoons of peas into them sometimes, you know. And so a portion, what would be considered a serving by this mom, she'd be so grateful on some days that that would be consumed. Whereas when we're talking a teenager, they can wolf down half a loaf of bread before you've even noticed it. And so we've got really different concepts here. But what they've done is make portion numbers of servings for different ages. And this works quite well. So you might have only a couple of servings, and that might be spread over the day for a toddler, and then have quite a significant number. One thing in the new guide, we've got quite an emphasis on vegetables and fruit, so the servings can be even up to 8 or 9 servings for a day.
Give us an idea of a serving size.
Okay, serving size for vegetables and fruits is a half cup of vegetables and fruits, or if it's salad, then 1 cup. So for some people, I know a lot of people I know are eating significant amounts of raw foods and can easily be eating 9 cups in a day. And this is recommended, say, for males, that they have 8 to 9 cups of vegetables and fruits, or 8 to 9 servings, rather, which could be. So this could be, for example, having for breakfast, some papaya, some grapefruit, banana, maybe 1 or 2 things there, and having a great big salad at lunch, having an apple sometime through the day, having a potato and some peas or something like that at night. And so over the course of the day, it's quite easy to get your 8 or 9 servings. And for females, it's only 7 servings so it's a bit less. But for many people, vegetables, you can eat a lot of them and you won't gain excess weight. So that's kind of like a minimum.
I was very discouraged by the inclusion of white bread in one of the guides, and the defense of this inclusion by the bureaucrat who was in charge, and she claimed that folic acid and the enrichment of white flour made it the equivalent, or at least something that could be recommended as a necessary part of the diet. What do you think of that?
Well, I'm glad to see that actually they've pictured on the draft, they've got whole grain breads and whole grain things like naan pictured first. And so I think there is quite an emphasis on that. I would certainly like more emphasis. And by the way, if anybody, any listeners want to comment or send in ideas, they can go to www.healthcanada.ca and then /food guide.
And so, they recommend white rice, not brown rice.
Well,
have you seen that? Have you noticed that? It's white rice.
On the draft version, the kind of big spread out version of it, they have wild or brown rice
right.
mentioned. And then in another place, they have
right.
rice or couscous, which
yeah.
personally I think are pretty useless. But we do find that many population groups, it's good if they're even eating that instead of something really junky, like a sugary donut or something like
well,
that.
Well, all Asians eat white rice, though. Isn't that part of the
part of
the problem?
Right. So, well, I think it's just something we have to take into account the way Canadians really eat and keep moving mm-hmm. people towards health. And I find I do a lot of consulting, consult for the government, consult for individuals, and I think you have to work with where people are at and then help them find healthier choices.
Well, I think a guide should be an exact guide rather than saying, oh, you can go this way, sort of just drift along there. You might hit the town or you might not,
well,
but it's close enough.
You think, though, if somebody wants you to change a habit that you do not want to change, if they just come on onto you personally, just think of something that somebody has told you that they thought you should do and you don't want to. If they're just going to come on dogmatically like that, you won't be open to them.
Okay. Well,
and that's one of the challenges in a guide, is that we have to look at what people are willing to do. And what I see as positive is that they've moved the good choices up to the front.
Well, it seems a very slow process, but anyway, you know...
It is slow, you're right. And I agree with your sympathy.
They're 100 years behind the times.
I think you're
even the process which they've gone through in consulting people has taken 4 years. Now, thank you for all the information and your wonderful books, which people can get by referring to your webpage. If you can give it to us again, NutriSpeak.com. Maybe you'd like to spell that out.
That's right, okay. It's www.nutrispeak.com, and I'm based in Langley, near Fort Langley.
Langley, wonderful Langley, pastoral Langley. Thank you, Vasanta Molina, and we certainly hope that Health Canada can now come up with a food guide that is less compromised and more reflective of what people need to achieve good health, and you're assisting with that.
Oh, so, I applaud you. Good sentiments. Exactly.
Thank you, Vicento.
Okay, bye for now.
Bye for now. And you've been listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM. And we have 5 minutes left and maybe a little tune.
Maybe we should people should read the article that appeared in, what was it, Common Ground or Shared Vision. By Louise Light, who was one of the USDA scientists who led, actually, who developed the eating guide that became known as the Food Guide Pyramid in the United States. And she says, carefully reviewing the research on nutrient recommendations, disease prevention, documented dietary shortfalls, and major health problems of the population, we submitted the final version of our new food guide to the Secretary of Agriculture. And then she says, when our version of the guide came back to us revised, we were shocked to find that it was vastly different from the one we had developed. And that is because the so-called stakeholders had had a say in it. Well, there should be no stakeholders. It should be scientific, rigorous opinion, and nothing else. Not stakeholders, because stakeholders want shelf life and all kinds of things that have nothing to do with the quality and nutrition of food, except to demote those qualities and conditions.
Yes, John, I have a total indifference towards the inclusion of any dairy products in the food guide, and one of the reasons is, as we all know, is that all cow's milk has some 59 different active hormones. Of those 59 hormones, one is a powerful growth hormone called IGF-1. And by freak of nature, it is identical in cows and humans. The medical world says IGF-1 is a key factor in the rapid growth and proliferation of breast, prostate, and colon cancers. IGF-1 is a normal part of all milk. Consumers don't think anything about it because they do not have a clue to the problem. Nor do most of our doctors, and that's a quote from notmilk.com. You can also go to milksucks.com, and it's a PETA thing. So, as we know, industry regulates what we eat. It is now, to my mind, in a large way also advising us about what our guidelines should be, what everybody should be consuming on a daily basis. So we have a few minutes left, and we have a little story here. It's a wonderful little story by, ta-da! I have a host of papers on my desk here. It's about a donkey. Well, I learned to love donkeys, and where is this? It's a donkey that fell into a well. And what happened was that everybody got very upset because they wanted to save this donkey. So one day they invited all the neighbors to come over and help. And they all grabbed shovels and began to shovel dirt into the well. At first the donkey realized what was happening and cried horribly. Then, to everybody's amazement, he quietened down. A few shovel loads later, the farmer finally looked down at the well. He was astonished at what he saw. With each shovel of dirt that had hit the donkey's back, the donkey was doing something amazing. He would shake it off and take a step up. As the farmer's neighbors continued to shovel dirt on top of the animal, he would shake it off and take a step up. Pretty soon, everybody was as amazed as the donkey stepped up over the edge of the well, and everybody happily trotted off. So I wish all stories could end as happily as that one. You're listening to Animal Voices, our program, which features the many of the issues which deals with the animal issues, factory farming, as you've heard today, the issue of how we envision a world where human beings will no longer kill, maim, torture, and exploit fellow beings for food, entertainment, animal experimentation, or any other purpose. Like all of us, animals are capable of suffering, and they are not ours to use for food, clothing, entertainment, experimentation, or any other reason. You've been listening to Animal Voices. Thank you for listening. Our webpage is www.animalvoices.org, and many of our programs are posted on our webpage. Over and out.